I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author and journalist Simon Winchester. And now, join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Simon Winchester.
It is a true honor to present Simon Winchester, a historian with a thirst for knowledge that is seemingly unquenchable and a biography that seems nearly fictional in scope. So I just want to tell you a little bit about Simon because I am totally fascinated by his entire life. Simon Winchester, Officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to journalism and literature, is a writer, journalist, broadcaster, and adventurer. Though not Catholic, he was educated first at a boarding convent in Dorset, where he achieved the dubious dual distinction of being appointed head of house and soon thereafter being expelled for a spectacularly destructive experiment in the science lab. After taking time off to hitchhike around Canada and the U.S., he went to Oxford, where he was a member of a six-man sledding expedition onto an uncharted section of the East Greenland ice cap in 1965 as part of the University Exploration Club. After graduation, Simon joined a Canadian mining company and worked in Uganda, then on an offshore oil rig in the North Sea, and then became a journalist. As a journalist for The Guardian, he covered, it seems to me, pretty much every major event in modern history, from Bloody Sunday in Ireland to Watergate here on our shores, to a stint as India correspondent. And to get to his post in New Delhi, Simon drove his family Volvo from Oxford to India through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, where he covered, in India, Indira Gandhi's rule, the Soviet-backed coup d'etat in Afghanistan, and more. Of course, he would happen to be in the Falkland Islands when they were invaded by Argentine forces, captured in southern Patagonia and imprisoned for 3 months. And then, obviously, also would be a man who would find himself in Hong Kong when the handover to China happened in 1997. That was all before he started writing and publishing his wonderful best-selling books. In 1998, The Best-Selling Professor and the Madman was published, a book about a forgotten American player and the extraordinary story of the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. And that book thrust Simon onto the international nonfiction best-selling stage. Since then, he's written so many terrific award-winning books about all wonderful subjects, nearly every subject under the sun. My personal favorite about our 1906 earthquake, A Crack in the Edge of the World, and 2011's Atlantic. He is here tonight to tell us all about the Pacific, the subject of his new book, which I think should also win an award for longest subtitle. It's Pacific, Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Already shortlisted for the Kirkus Prize for Nonfiction and longlisted for the Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Nonfiction, Pacific also garnered a really wonderful review in this week's New York Times and is the book I just can't put down this week. So please join me to welcome Simon Winchester and his Tales of Our Pacific Ocean.
That is truly the nicest introduction I think I've ever had, although where you get all this business about being expelled from school, it's not on Wikipedia, so I don't know where you get it from. But anyway, I'm delighted, and I thank you for coming along and for inviting me here tonight. But my publicist has people to thank as well because of the extraordinary coincidence. You publish a book about the Pacific, and the week that you do it, what happens, or the month that you do it, what happens, you get this extraordinary, the world's biggest hurricane, Patricia, roaring out of the Pacific and threatening to destroy much of Mexico. In fact, of course, it turned out to be a bit of a dud. I say that in journalistic terms, meaning it didn't kill anybody. Not that I would wish it to kill people, but nonetheless, there was that. And then the foreign minister, I think probably not many of you will be aware of this, because it's in London. The foreign minister of the Marshall Islands is in London this week, pleading for the Bikini Islanders who were forced out of their island by atomic testing in the 1950s onto a miserable little island called Kili. That island, because of the rise in sea level, is now flooding, and so their home is being destroyed, and so they're pleading with the British government to let them be taken in by Britain. And then you've got all this nonsense going on in the South China Sea at the moment with the destroyer, the Lassen, sailing sort of provocatively close to these new Chinese-owned little coral atolls. So my publicist in New York is just completely thrilled because the Chinese business is in Chapter 10, rising sea level is in Chapter 8, the plight of the Bikini Islanders is Chapter 1. So she says, you know, go for it. And so I've just actually written today a piece for the New York Times op-ed pages, which I think is going to be in on Friday. So it's a very topical ocean, and whether that means the book will sell, who knows, but at least it augurs rather well. So the basic thesis of this book is very simple. It's the idea is that if the Mediterranean was the inland sea of the classical world, which I think probably most people would agree with, then you can probably, it's a hop, skip, and a jump from there to say that the Atlantic is the inland sea of today's world. And if you accept that thesis, and that was the basis of a book I wrote a couple of years ago about the Atlantic, then the Pacific is, it can be argued, the inland sea of tomorrow's world. So that was the sort of guiding principle. And I then had to tackle the issue of how do you write a book about this immense entity, because it is gigantic. Robinson Jeffers, the American poet who lived at Big Sur, called it the great unsleeping eye of the Earth. It's this huge blue thing which occupies one third of the planet's surface. It's so big that all the other oceans and all the continents could fit into it handily. It's if you stand on Panama and gaze over towards Indonesia, it's 10,600 miles. I mean, it's seriously big. And billions of people live around it. So how on earth do you write a book? How do you structure a book? If I was going to write about the modern Pacific and the future that I sort of discerned in it, then I wasn't going to write about the Pacific in antiquity, other than making a nod to it. So when to begin the story? And it seemed to me, I floundered around for a while thinking of a number of dates, and the first one I came up with was the 2nd of September 1945, which was the day of the Japanese surrender on the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. That seemed a new beginning for the Pacific. And then I thought possibly another beguiling date was the 10th of October 1949, 4 years later, which was when the People's Republic of China was declared by Mao Zedong in Tiananmen Square. So that was a possibility. It was clearly that was a hinge moment in world history. But in the end, I settled on another date, which had a beautiful logic to it, and that was the 1st of January 1950. And the wonderful thing I find about writing books like this is that I, as the author, and I do all, you know, the research myself, I don't have a team or anything, you learn stuff all the time, and I'll tell you one or two things I learned later on in this talk, but I learned what I'm about to tell you right off the get-go, and it was why I decided to start the book when I did. The 1st of January 1950 is important for the following reason. We now, or for many years, I mean for time immemorial really, have used, in the English language anyway, the dating system BC and AD. Things happened in the past a number of years. BC, the Roman invasion of Britain, 55 BC, every schoolchild I think knows that. And this is AD 2015. So before Christ and Anno Domini, the year of the Lord. And that's all fine and dandy for Christians, but of course an awful lot of people are not Christian, and BC and AD mean very little to them. And so in recent years, sensitive to this, there's been a fudge has been invented, and that fudge are the initials BCE. You talk about events having occurred 55 BCE, which is, for those that still have an affection for the Christian system, before Christian era, or more usually, it stands for BCE is before Common Era. And that's fine and dandy, except it's not really fine for the scientific community, who wanted something rather more rigorous and meaningful and didn't relate to any sort of religious figure whatsoever. And they came up with the construction of BP. And BP, we talk about, for instance, the things happening in considerable antiquity, like the Wisconsin Ice Age. You talk about having happened 5,000 or 10,000 years, I think it was, 10,000 years BP. And BP stands, as I'm sure you all know, for before present. But that, however, raises the question, well, when is present? And that was decided by a group of radiochemists, oddly enough, at Queen's University in Belfast about 20 years ago, that present, the index year, year zero, moment zero, is the 1st of January 1950. And the reason for this has a beautiful logic to it and a relevance, as it turns out, to the Pacific Ocean. It's all to do with carbon dating. And I'll try not to be too tedious about this, and I won't be too long about it, but as you probably know and remember from school, in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, there are two principal isotopes of carbon. There's carbon-12, which is stable, and there's carbon-14, which is unstable and decays. It has a half-life. In other words, half of it will disappear after 7,530 years. It's a crucial and memorable figure. So if a tree dies, let's say, if a dead tree is found, and when it dies, it therefore stops absorbing carbon dioxide through its leaves, it will have, when it dies, at the moment of its death, the same ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14 as exists in the atmosphere, which is about one atom of carbon-14 to 1 trillion atoms of carbon-12. But the difference is that once it's dead and has stopped absorbing carbon, the carbon-14 will decay. So in 7,530 years, only half of the carbon will be there, and after another 7,530 years, half of the remaining carbon will be there. So if you can work out, if you can measure the amount of carbon, you can find out exactly when it died, how old it is. However, the problem, and that was perfectly fine until the 1st of January 1950, and then we started testing atom bombs in earnest. And one of the fission products, and indeed fusion products, of a nuclear explosion is carbon-14. And carbon-14 was therefore thrown up into the atmosphere in great abundance and started destroying and distorting the ratio that you're beginning with. The ratio went up considerably from, you know, whatever, 1 to a trillion to 1 to half a trillion or something like that. And so all the carbon-14 dating measurements went completely crazy, and they had to introduce an algorithm every year to make them accurate. They just threw up their hands in horror. And this went on for, the atmospheric testing went on into the mid-1960s. Of course, the French, being the French, continued atmospheric testing for some years afterwards. But anyway, the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere fluctuated, and everything was crazy. And so these geochemists or biochemists or radiochemists in Belfast came up with the idea that before 1950, the world was pure, and after 1950, the world was essentially impure. And as it happened, for my purposes, the impurities were all, or almost all, generated in the Pacific Ocean. So there couldn't be a better symbolic moment with which to begin this book. So I now had a start point for the book and an end point, which, and I'll tell you why in a moment, is May the 14th, 2014. So 65 years in essence. And the way I decided to write the book, I was going to make a list of all the newsworthy events that I could find that occurred during those 65 years and look at them very closely and parse them and winnow them down until I had 10 events, because I think 10 chapters is a good number for a book. And each of those 10 would be sufficiently important that it would indicate a trend in the Pacific that would produce, when taken as a whole, a portrait of the Pacific today and how, in my opinion, it would develop in the future. And this book will live or die according to the wisdom or otherwise of the choices I made. So at the moment, the critics have been very kind. As was mentioned, the New York Times on Monday was terrific. So no one thus far has been particularly hostile to the 10 I've chosen. So what I thought I'd do, and they're in chronological order, so I'll just vaguely indicate the first two or three and indicate the kind of thing that I think was important, because I winnowed them down from 250 to 10, so these 10 were very deliberately chosen. So the book begins on the 1st of January 1950. The first event, as it happens, is the 4th of January 1950, and that's when President Truman stands up before the Houses of Congress to give his State of the Union address for the year. And he makes two announcements which are key to this story. The first is that the United States government is going to develop a new type of atomic weapon. We all know that, you know, leading up to the explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, the United States was highly competent in building fission bombs, in other words, normal, what we call A-bombs. But the scientists at Los Alamos said that it's possible, now we've mastered this particular technology, to create a much more powerful weapon of theoretically limitless power based on fusion of hydrogen. And so these were the new generation of hydrogen bombs or thermonuclear bombs. And America was going to start developing them. And in the development, they were going to test them. And where were they going to test them? But they were going to test them in the Pacific Ocean. And specifically, they were going to test them in the Marshall Islands and on one island that they chose right at the beginning called Bikini. And there's a lot about nuclear weapons in this book, and I shall go on a little bit later to talk about one specifically callous act that underlines this particular story. But I was reminded of this earlier today when I was talking about it, how the Bible was used to justify the explosions of these early weapons. These poor people, if you can imagine the Bikinians, this idyllic island, a typical classical South Pacific island, actually happens to be in the North Pacific, but it looks beautiful, you know, palm trees leading into the trade winds, a beautiful lagoon, people just fishing and mending their nets and paddling their outriggers. All of these people are Christians because they had been visited by missionaries in the 19th century, and the missionaries had, you know, been appalled at their nakedness and their primitiveness and had taught them something about the Bible. And they all wore muumuus and Mother Hubbards and looked ridiculous. And anyway, it was decided for a lot of technical reasons that Bikini would be the ideal place to test these weapons. And so it was decided that a young officer from the U.S. Navy and the Pentagon should be sent to Bikini to persuade the locals that the Americans should allow these people, the island, to be used as a testing ground and that the people should be asked to leave. And so the officer that went, and there's a YouTube video, which if you've never seen it, it's quite extraordinary to watch, an archival film, of this officer reminding, he's this young, clean-cut, often looked like Tyrone Power or someone like that, with a group of these islanders sitting trustingly around him and the sand and the beach, you know, the surf is racing up the beach and so on. And he's saying to them, you may remember from the Bible the Israelites being led out behind a pillar of fire. Well, we Americans can create a pillar of fire with this new device that we have made. And we want to test this pillar of fire here on your island. We're doing the work of God for the good of man. So, tempted by the vision of this pillar of fire, will you kindly follow it and leave the island, please, while we conduct these experiments, and then you can come back later. I mean, what happened to them is tragic and astonishing, and I'll tell you one particular story about it later on. But very trustingly, they left, and they're now in a state of utter misery and poverty, living far, far away from their homelands, and the islands of the Bikini Atoll, where they came from, are uninhabitable, and the whole place is a miserable disaster. So that's effectively chapter one. Chapter two is much more cheerful than that, and chapter three even more cheerful. Chapter two, and I promise you I'm not going to go through all of them, but this just gives you a flavor of the thing. Chapter two, it begins in, of all places, Edmonton, Alberta, and by extraordinary coincidence, I was in Edmonton, Alberta, last week talking about this book, because they had a little literary festival. I hope there's no one here from Edmonton here tonight, because I think it's an unutterably ghastly place. I mean, it was cold, it was dark, it was windy, there are no trees whatsoever, and all the architecture is sort of the worst of the 1970s. It's really not a good place at all. But as it happens, it plays a very important part in this story, because in 1955, you see we've moved on from 1950, we're now going chronologically in order, in I think it was August the 8th, I think it was 1955, in Edmonton, in Winnipeg in Manitoba and in Vancouver in British Columbia, there are electronic stores. And in these stores, there appeared in the window a new device, a tiny little shirt pocket-sized radio set called the TR-55, on sale for $35 or $40, I think it was. It was a new kind of radio.
You're listening to author and journalist Simon Winchester, whose latest book is Pacific, Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And before 1955, radio sets were essentially pieces of furniture. They sat in the corner of the living room. They were covered with walnut veneer or something. You put an aspidistra on top. You turned them on. They warmed up. They hummed. You tuned them in. And you listened to your radio program. Now, all of a sudden, with the arrival of this thing in the shops in Canada, the radio, you could take it with you. You could take it into the garden or by the swimming pool or to school or to bed or wherever you wanted. It was a personal electronic device. And of course, what it was a transistor radio, the first ever transistor radio. And it was made in Japan by a company which had its name around the little tuning dial at the top, called Totsco, for Tokyo Telecommunications Company. And underneath, in a tiny little, they weren't very confident of the wisdom of their choice of name of the company, they had the four letters, the word Sony. It was the first ever Sony device. And it was made in Japan. I mean, if we think of the Sony Corporation at all, we think of this rather smooth, silver-haired man called Akio Morita, who's the sort of public face of Sony. But this invention was made by an engineer, a sort of rough, tough Tokyo engineer called Masaru Ibuka, who made model railway trains and helium balloons and an accomplished accordion player and all sorts of extraordinary things. A wonderful man. And he went on to invent not just the transistor radio, but he invented, if you remember it, the Walkman, the Sony Walkman. He invented the Trinitron television. He invented the Betamax recorder. He was an amazing fellow. But it so happened, well, a number of things happened around the TR-55. It was quite popular in Canada, but they had only imported about 100 of them. But then they tested and they imported about 4,000 to America and specifically to New York. And they were put in a warehouse in Queens, along with lots of other electronic equipment. And astonishingly, or delightfully, the warehouse was burgled. And there was a story in the New York Times buried deep on page 17 saying, you know, electronic heist in Queens. And it turns out that the burglars had only taken these radios. They had left all everything else in the store behind. They had taken 4,000 tiny shirt pocket size Sony TR-55 radios. And New Yorkers read this and thought to themselves, well, if it's good enough for the burglars, it's good enough for us. And they ordered them in their tens of thousands. As luck would have it, almost at exactly the same moment on the Atlantic coast of the United States, the shipping container was invented. And so a container ship was built, several of them in the next few months, loaded with shipping containers full of these radios and other Sony-made devices, better radios, smaller radios, different colored radios. And they came over to America, and thus began the pattern of trade across the Pacific, which continues to this very day, going dramatically. Huge numbers of ships going from the ports of Yokohama to places like Vancouver and San Francisco and Long Beach. But later, I mean, not only obviously with Sony goods, but also with Panasonic and all those other Japanese companies. And then in later years, companies like Samsung over in Korea, and then to the Chinese companies of today. So if you stand on the Golden Gate Bridge today and watch one of these great evergreen container ships sweeping into the ports in Oakland, you can remember that this all began on the 8th of August, 1955, with a radio set being advertised for sale in an electronics store in, of all places, that most miserable city of Edmonton, Alberta. The third chapter, and I believe you me, I'll stop at the third chapter, relates to something that looks on the surface trivial, but I hope when I explain it, it turns out not to be. And that was the opening of a movie it was Columbia Pictures that opened it on April the 23rd, I think Shakespeare's birthday as it happens, 1959, so we've marched on another few years. Columbia Pictures didn't really have the confidence in the picture to open it in Manhattan. They opened it out in Long Island. But the New York Times critic went to see it. He had a tip that it might be interesting and wrote a lyrical, or at least what passed for lyricism in the New York Times of 1959, review of it, saying this is an absolute must-see film for the summertime beach world of the year ahead. And the film, which I dare say some of you in the audience may dimly remember, is a very unexceptional, highly saturated, vaguely sexy, erotic film called Gidget, starring Sandra Dee as a young girl called Kathy Kona, who learned at the age of 14 and a half or 15, learned how to surf and be very good at it. And this spawned a fascination with the world of surfing. Surfing, or wave riding, it used to be called, standing on boards and going on the top of the breaking wave surface, was a sport which began in the Pacific, in Tahiti specifically, about 2,000 years ago, and it migrated northwards to Hawaii. And there was a tremendous hierarchy. The aristocrats and the kingly, the princely families of Hawaii had certain beaches, certain surf breaks, whereas the common people had others. There were three different types of surfboards, amazingly long ones, 21 feet long, if you can imagine trying to surf on a surfboard three times as tall as you are, at least four times maybe. And the thing about the surfing world in Hawaii is that the surfers surfed naked. And quite an impressive thought. I mean, these gigantic Hawaiian men, totally naked on the top of these surfboards, we might think that was an attractive sight today, but the missionaries who came, they were shocked beyond belief. And they said to the surfers, I'm so sorry, we're here now, we're taking charge. So you can surf if you like, but if you do, you have to wear Mother Hubbards, you have to wear muumuus while you're doing it, or you don't surf at all. And they, not unreasonably, said, well, in that case, we're not going to surf in muumuus. I mean, how ridiculous is that? So effectively, they gave it up, except the children. And the children used these little 4.5-foot-long surfboards called pupau, and they were discovered, first seen by Jack London, when he was sailing in the Snark across the Pacific, and he was resting for a couple of weeks in Hawaii, and was swimming one day with his wife in Waikiki, which was a small village at the time, and suddenly he was overtaken by dozens of these adorable little children all standing on little tiny surfboards and having a whale of a time. And he thought, this is just wonderful. This is bliss. I must learn how to do it. Will you teach me? And he was taught how to do it, and he had this amazing sort of epiphany where he could do it. He could ride on a wave, and it's an extraordinary, blissful moment. And he wrote this extraordinary, enthusiastic essay in the October 1907 issue of the Women's Home Companion, Surfing the King of Sports. And it took off as a result. The magazine, the piece was syndicated. It was in the Pall Mall Gazette. It was in a magazine in Australia. And all of a sudden, surfing beaches opened up, Redondo Beach in Southern California, Malibu, Bondi Beach in Australia. And this, the Pacific's gift to playtime, started to become practiced beyond Hawaii and Tahiti and on the shores. But it wasn't really a popular sport worldwide until 1959, when Gidget suddenly became the movie to see in 1959. And it developed into the industry it is today, which is a $13 billion a year industry, and which has more than simply playtime, because a number of companies have now adjusted their working schedules to accommodate the needs of surfers. And the first one to do this was the Patagonia Company. And its creator, a man called Yvon Chouinard, decided that he would build factories close to the sea to produce his, you know, all the outdoor clothing and stuff. And if the surf was up, he'd say, go off and surf. And then when the waves diminish, come back, and you'll come back happy, and you'll put in time for my company, and the productivity of the company will therefore, in my view, increase. And it did. It worked brilliantly. And so whenever you have a recognition of a company now that has flex time as its policy, that really began in response to surfing and those companies that were built on and around the Pacific Coast Highway in Southern and Northern California in the 1970s and 80s. A nice little coda to this is that the other day I had a letter from Gidget. Gidget Kathy Koner is now Kathy Zimmerman, and she is, I don't want to be rude about this, but she said she's in her early 70s. She still surfs every day. She works in a restaurant in Malibu, and twice a week she works in a bookshop. And she had picked up this and sees that chapter 3 in the book is all about her early days, so she wants to have lunch with me. So one of the wonderful benefits of writing this book is that next week I think I'm in Southern California and I get to have lunch with Gidget. I mean, can life get any better? So it goes on. There are chapters about coral bleaching, and there are chapters inevitably about the coming confrontation with the Chinese. And then there's an epilogue, which I'll talk about in a bit more detail in a few moments. So what I thought I'd do is, going back to the point I was making earlier, that when you write this kind of a book, you're just learning all the time. I'll tell you a couple of things that I did learn, which I thought were absolutely fascinating. One of them relates, I don't want you to think I'm obsessed with nuclear weapons, but this particular story is something I found out, which I thought was an amazing illustration of the cavalier callousness that so many Westerners have demonstrated towards the Pacific, and which I hope is going to be reversed, and the closing remarks, I think, will indicate that it is. This relates to a man, and I love having a villain in the story. This is a man called Alvin Graves, who I think is very much a villain. He was a nuclear physicist working in Los Alamos in the 1940s. And many of you have seen the movie rendition of this particular story, because there is a movie and it's a very dramatic moment in the movie. It relates to an experiment being done with an early core of a prototype nuclear weapon, and they do what's called tickling the dragon's tail. They have these two hemispheres of finely machined plutonium, about 3.5 inches in diameter, such that if they assembled them both together, they form a critical mass and the thing would explode. So what they've done, or what the experiment was, it was conducted by a Brooklyn-born nuclear physicist called Louis Slotin. He's standing in this room behind a wall of beryllium bricks to shield him from the radiation. And on a sort of tower behind, on the other side of the bricks, is one of these hemispheres with its flat, perfectly machined, mirror-smooth surface uppermost. And balanced just about on top of it is the other hemisphere, but separated from it by the blade of a screwdriver, which he's holding vertically, such that the upper hemisphere is separated from the lower hemisphere by about half an inch, or quarter of an inch. So the Geiger counters are ticking over because an amount of radiation is being released. There are 3 or 4 other physicists in the room, and directly behind Louis Slotin is this man, Alvin Graves, taking notes. So very carefully, Slotin turns the blade of the screwdriver by about 5 degrees, and this lowers the upper hemisphere, brings it closer to the lower hemisphere, and all the Geiger counters start chattering away, and the needles on the dials go to the right-hand side, and everyone's taking notes of what's happening. And very carefully, Slotin returns the screwdriver to vertical, and the reaction stops. Makes sure that everyone is all right. He does it again, only this time more so. He turns it to about 45 degrees, and so the two hemispheres come very much closer to touching, and the Geiger counters go really crazy, and the needles go almost off scale, everyone calmly taking notes. And then he reverts it to normal again, and the reaction stops. And then he does it for a third time when he's hoping to bring it down to there, almost touching. But then at that moment, someone in the room drops a teacup. And this startles him, and he accidentally pulls the screwdriver out, and the two hemispheres touch each other. And instantly there's this flash of blinding blue light known as Cherenkov radiation, and the room is flooded with gamma radiation, and all the Geiger counters go crazy, every instrument in the room goes off scale, the room is flooded with dangerous, dangerous, lethal radiation. So Slotin does the only thing he can possibly do. He reaches over with his right hand and pushes the upper hemisphere off the lower one onto the floor, and the reaction stops. The room quietens. And he screeches to everyone, stay where you are. And he picks up a batch of dosimeters and throws them to the various people, including one to Alvin Graves behind, and calculates very swiftly but very accurately what is likely to have happened. And after about 10 minutes of calculation, he says, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. You, Alvin Graves, are probably going to die, but I am certainly going to die, and I'm going to die in 9 days. And sure enough, he's exactly right. In 9 days' time, with his hand blown up to the size of a football with edema, he dies of excruciating radiation poisoning. Alvin Graves is terribly, terribly sick. He's in hospital for more than a year. He has all manner of transfusions, blood, of course, bone marrow, all sorts of things. But steadily, he recovers. And a year after the accident, he's returned to normal life, just a small patch of balding hair on the top of his head. Otherwise, he's fine. But what has changed about him more than anything is his attitude to radiation. He, from that moment on, believes that if you're a man, radiation is something that you can survive very easily. Radiation sickness, he said, was a conspiracy put about by weaklings, and that anyone can absorb radiation and shrug it off. Well, you would have thought with a lunatic view like that, he would be sidelined into some desk job, but he wasn't. He was made, when they came to test the really big thermonuclear weapons in the mid-1950s, particularly what's known as the Castle series, who was made director of the testing program but Alvin Graves. And what he did on this particular day, March the 1st, 1954, is something which I just think he's criminally responsible. They were blowing up. The second of these tests was of a cylinder. It was about 10 feet long. The hydrogen, I mean, I won't go into the technique of doing it, but you have to have a fission bomb as a trigger and then a substance with hydrogen in it, in this case a chemical called lithium dihydride, which produces the hydrogen, which is squeezed together to form essentially a reaction like that in the sun. Well, they had first of all made a major miscalculation. They thought this bomb would have a yield of 17 megatons, TNT equivalent. And you've got to remember that the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima was 25 kilotons. This is hugely much bigger. Well, they miscalculated. It turns out they'd put too much of this lithium dihydride in it, and the eventual explosion was of 50 megatons, the biggest weapon that the United States has ever exploded in its history. But on the day before the test, and indeed for 2 weeks before the test, the wind over the Bikini Atoll was blowing to the northwest. There were very few islands, none of them inhabited, no ships in the area, to the extent that it was safe, knowing that a huge amount of radioactive fallout would be produced, the wind was in the right direction. But the night before the explosion, the wind shifted and blew towards the east. And to the east, there were two inhabited islands, Rongelap and Rongerik, with several hundred people. And knowing that the wind was blowing in the what was now the wrong direction, a lethal direction, everyone in the Navy and in the Army, people responsible for the mechanics of the test, said to Graves, don't explode it. A huge amount of radiation is going to come about. And he said, you're being ridiculous. And strong men like these islanders, they'll get over it. I got over it. Anyone can get over radiation. Press the button. And he said, everyone said, no, don't press the button. He ordered, he was the director. They pressed the firing button. This titanic explosion occurred, sending a column 25 miles high with a mushroom cloud 60 miles across. I mean, it was unbelievably big. And the radiation swept over the two islands within an hour after the explosion, when the islanders who had seen this great, what appeared to be sunrise in the east and in the west and heard this enormous rumble, this roar of the explosion, suddenly flakes of white substance, which they believed initially to be snow, which they had heard about, started falling from the sky. It was actually calcined coral. And they would pick it up and they'd lick it and taste it and see what it was. Within 2 hours, they were all staggering about, suffering from the most terrible sickness. But what did the Americans do? They didn't immediately go in and treat them as they had treated Alvin Graves. They said, this is an interesting experiment. We can see how these people perform having been exposed to a vast amount of radiation. After about 4 days, thanks to the Interior Secretary, who heard about this back in Washington, and he said, this is no way to treat human beings. They were, in fact, evacuated and lived in Kwajalein for a while in the central Marshall Islands and were very, very sick. Some of them died. There were cancers. There were stillbirths. There were deformed children. And the population of Rongelap and Rongerik has never gotten over it. So I always think the Alvin Graves story is a marvelous illustration of how we have ill-treated these people in a cavalier, callous manner.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author and journalist Simon Winchester, whose latest book is Pacific: Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The second story, and it relates to North Korea. I'm fascinated with North Korea. I've been a number of times. And what I discovered that I didn't know was that it was invented. It was created by an American. And moreover, an American with a wonderful name. I love people with marvelous names. His name was Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III. I mean, don't get much better names than that. And he was a young colonel. If you can imagine the scenario, it's the 14th of August, 1945. And Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III and his buddy, Dean Rusk, who you will know, who went on to be Secretary of State in the Kennedy administration, are in the young colonels in the outer office of George Marshall, the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. And they're listening over the shortwave radio to Emperor Hirohito over in Japan, surrendering, giving that amazing speech, the first time his voice had ever been heard, that masterly piece of understatement, "The progress of the war has not necessarily gone to our advantage," he said. "I'll say. And we're surrendering." And so Bonesteel and Rusk, essentially in the outer office, said, "Well, that's the Japanese problem over, but the big problem now is the Soviets," because the Soviets, who had joined the war only a week previously, were marching down through Japanese-held territory, Sakhalin Island, marching down through Manchuria, marching into Korea. If the Americans didn't act quickly, then all of Northeast Asia was potentially going to be communist. You'd have a communist Japan, communist Korea. It would be, in the American view, a mess. So they had to be stopped. So where to stop them? So Bonesteel had on his desk a 1944 issue of the National Geographic magazine, and you may remember that they would include maps in the Geographic, and he opened this one, and it did have a map, one of these free maps, and he spread it out, and it was Japan and the North Pacific. And he was showing it to Rusk and said, "Isn't it droll that San Francisco and Seoul, the old capital of Korea," and of course Korea was at this time a Japanese colony, "are on almost exactly the same latitude, 37 degrees 40 north. I think," said Bonesteel, "that it would be appropriate if we Americans kept control of the old capital of Seoul. So why don't we ask the Russians to stop a little bit north? How about the 38th parallel?" And Rusk said, "Yeah, 38 looks pretty good." So they took a chinagraph pencil and drew a line across the Pacific to San Francisco, but in bisecting Korea at the 38th parallel, and took it into George Marshall. And he said, "Yeah, the 38th parallel, that seems a pretty neat idea. So let's tell the State Department and they'll tell Moscow." Well, the next day, Moscow said, incredibly, "You know, we're pretty tired. Our troops are exhausted. It's high summer. They've been racing through Manchuria. Our tanks keep getting bogged down in the mud and the mosquitoes and everything. So, yes, we will stop where you suggest, the 38th parallel." So they stopped their tanks. The Americans brought in troops to Incheon and occupied the southern part of Korea. The Americans appointed their own local commander, a man called Syngman Rhee, Lee Syngman. And in the north, the Russians appointed Kim Il-sung as their local man. And from that moment on, two completely different countries began slowly and steadily to develop. They went to war in the 1950s. There was an armistice, peace treaty, which, of course, the war has never technically ended. There's this gigantic 4-kilometer-wide DMZ separating the two countries. And North Korea, to the north, develops its own nuclear weapons. The Kim dynasty continues, and it's a sort of insane, diabolical nation, which was created effectively by that drawing of a line on a National Geographic map in 1945. And there's a lovely coda to this as well. The story that I choose to tell, the North Korea chapter, to begin it with, begins in 1968 with the capture of the USS Pueblo, a spy ship that Americans were spying off the east coast of Korea. It was captured. It remains now in Pyongyang. It's a museum piece, although the U.S. Navy regards it still as a ship, a commissioned warship, just temporarily absent from duty. And the 80-odd crew members were captured, of course, and subject to the most terrible privations. They were tortured, they were starved, they were beaten up, they had a horrid, horrid time. But they were, eventually, there were negotiations conducted by the Johnson administration and Kim Il-sung's people, and eventually it was agreed they would be released. And so the release date came 2 days before Christmas, 1968. And so if you can imagine, there's this thing, I don't know how many of you have been to Panmunjom, but there's this horrible old concrete bridge called the Bridge of No Return. And on the northern side of it, on this particular day, were the two North Korean army trucks bringing the American prisoners, emaciated and hungry and miserable, didn't really know they were going to be released. And it was agreed that they would be ordered to march across the Bridge of No Return into the South and into the arms of their waiting American friends. So they went every 20 seconds, or maybe it was 20 yards apart, ordered not to turn round, not to wave, not to run, not to make any gestures of farewell or anything else, with the captain, Lloyd Bucher, being the first. And so they came across one by one by one, leaving behind misery and grimness and lantern-jawed guards and a diet of unremitting turnips or something and communism and propaganda. And as they crossed the line, big, beefy, smiling Americans with orange juice and steak and Christmas and freedom and television and all these good things. But the person that greeted each and every one of them, the first handshake they had, was from the commander of United Nations forces in South Korea, the now General Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III, the person that had created the mess in the first place. And it often strikes me, it's all to do partly, and much of the book is about the interference of us, maybe well-meaning interference, with the affairs of the Pacific. If Bonesteel had never drawn that line, if the Koreas had never been divided, then Korea would have been, yes, a communist peninsula jutting out into the Pacific. But communism, given time, withered and died. I mean, Vietnam was communist. Cambodia, where my son lives, it's his birthday today. That's no longer a communist state. And it would have been the same, I think, in Korea. And Korea would not have been a divided country. There would be no DMZ, no need to have 25,000 American troops there, no need to worry about North Korea having developed nuclear weapons. So Charles Bonesteel, maybe for the best of intentions, interfered in the politics of Korea. And if he hadn't, the world might have been a much more peaceful place. So the last thing I'm going to tell you is the sort of hopeful thing that I have written about in the epilogue. And this relates to a ship. It's in the end papers. You'll see a picture of it. Basically, what happened was this. In 1976, the Hawaiian people decided that their gift to America for the bicentenary would be that they would build, by hand, a replica of a Hawaiian traditional sailing canoe, a thing called a wa'a, 60 feet long, two hulls, a sort of catamaran, great big sails, and they would use it not so much as an object, but to revive a long-forgotten Polynesian technique, and that is of non-instrumental navigation, because the Polynesians used to navigate across the vast expanses of the Pacific Ocean without recourse to any aids at all. They had no watches, of course, to tell where north and south is. They had no compass. They had no sextant. They certainly had no GPS. There was one man, only one man, called Mao Piaoluk, who lived on Satawal, an island in the Caroline group. And they went down to see him from Hawaii and said, "We're building this amazing canoe. Do you think, as you know how to do this, you could come up and teach us how to navigate without instruments?" And he said yes. And he got on a plane. He'd never been on a plane before. Came to Honolulu, saw this wonderful craft, and said, "Yes, I can take it. Where do you want to go?" And they said, "Well, how about Tahiti, 2,500 miles south?" And he plotted a course and said, "I can get you there in 6 weeks." And so he put up a hammock between the two sailing sweeps at the back of the craft, and with 30 young men and women, they set off. And 6 weeks later, exactly, they got there, they raised the little island of Tahiti and got to the capital, Papeete. Hawaii went crazy with delight because a Polynesian skill had been revived. And so they then made other journeys. They went without instruments up to Japan, reminding the Japanese that they were very much Pacific people. They went to Haida Gwaii, the islands, the Queen Charlotte Islands off the west coast of British Columbia. They went to Vancouver. They came to San Francisco. They went to Lima in Peru. And they became thoroughly confident in this way of navigating. Mao Pialuk himself died, but they kept it on. There are now 300 people in Hawaii who can do this. And this year, or rather May the 14th, 2014, they set off on a venture to see if they can do this, take the Polynesian sailing tradition and go in this canoe round the world. So they set off from Maui on the 14th of May. They got easily to Tahiti, which by now was plain sailing, as it were. They turned right and went to Samoa. They went to Tokelau. They went to the Cook Islands, went down to New Zealand for Christmas, went across to Australia. And now when they went north of the Gulf of Carpentaria, they went into the Indian Ocean, an ocean they'd never been to. They're now, and you can check on their progress every day, it's the Polynesian Voyaging Society, is the website. They're just north of Mauritius this morning, I think. And they're deciding now whether to turn right and up to go up past the Horn of Africa, through the Red Sea, through Suez, turn left in the Mediterranean, through the Pillars of Hercules and out into the Atlantic that way, or more probably turn left, go south of Madagascar, go join the Agulhas Current, go around Cape Agulhas, go Cape of Good Hope, and into the Atlantic that way. But whichever way they enter the Atlantic, they then want to make as their central ambition for this part of the journey to sail in this boat up the Potomac and go and see their Hawaiian president, which would be an amazing moment if they do it, and then sail down the east coast of South America, not go through Panama, cut through the Straits of Magellan, just as Magellan did in 1529, and enter into the Pacific Ocean, and then make their way northwestwards to Hawaii and home. And the whole thing will take them 4 years. And gradually, as they do this, and as accomplishments like this become more and more well-known, I think we will give to these people, the Polynesians, who, like the Micronesians and the Melanesians and so many of the people around the ocean, we have disdained and disrespected and treated poorly, we will give them at long last what they deserve and what the ocean itself deserves. And that is, we regard them as a source of learning and a sort of wisdom and a people and a place to which we give our profound respect. So thank you very much indeed.
We have time for questions.
A big topic is just the condition of the Pacific Ocean. What you think of the ocean's prospects with climate change and human use, all the ships being dumping their stuff in?
I don't really know where to begin. I mean, we are causing immense damage, but the Pacific is very big, and up to a certain extent, it can absorb much of the damage we're doing. I mean, a wonderful illustration of the damage we're doing can be seen by this German project, which is tracking the emissions of big ships that occupy the trading routes. And you can see these big bands of what looks like smoke, which is particulate emissions from big ships, which just linger in the sky and then sink down into the sea, causing all sorts of mayhem locally. And then, of course, the currents swirl it around. You've got the whole garbage problem, which is perhaps not as dramatic to look at as many people think. You don't, when you're sailing from Honolulu to Vancouver, say, you do not suddenly enter an area filled with detergent bottles and milk crates and things. It's more microscopic particulate material, which is just as bad, but it's being absorbed by the fish and polluting in a very serious way in this area where the currents sort of form this circle where all the stuff materializes. You have overfishing, you have the dumping of marine waste, you have got, I mean, a classic example of the kind of thing that's going on is what's happening to the Great Barrier Reef, which is really, in environmental terms, one of the canaries in the coal mine, if you like, for how the Pacific is. And the bleaching of the corals in the Great Barrier Reef began in the mid-1980s. The corals are dying. And it is said that the Great Barrier Reef, the biggest living creature on the surface of the planet, or just below the surface of the sea, 1,400 miles long, is going to be 500 miles long in the next 50 years. I mean, it is dying as we watch it. And the Australian government isn't helping because, for a start, there are many, many farms on the Queensland coast eager to increase their production, putting all sorts of fertilizers which are leaching off into the rivers and flowing into the sea and damaging the barrier reef. More potently, more critically, Australia has this massive dependence on money from China and is selling every imaginable gram of coal that they produce to the Chinese and is building new coal ports in Queensland for Chinese coal ships to come and bring this endless amount of coal. And the Chinese navigators are not very good. And there was this case, I think, 2 years ago, a ship called the Shenneng II, which cut a corner, leaving a coal stay, then cut a 30-mile-long gash in the reef, which will take centuries to repair. And he was just hauled into court, given a slap on the wrist, and told not to do it again. Because the Chinese do not want to offend, or the Australians do not want to offend the Chinese and upset this very lucrative trade. So UNESCO, which has named, I think it's UNESCO, which has named the Barrier Reef a World Heritage Site, is threatening the Australian government that if they don't clean up their act, they will withdraw the heritage status for a reef which may in any case not exist by the end of this century. So we have damage to coral reefs. On the other hand, there are some success stories, and one of the success stories that I like to talk about involves one of the most beautiful birds in the Pacific, one of the albatrosses. The biggest of all, the biggest flying bird in the world, I think, is the wandering albatross, Diomedea exulans, which once you've seen it, if you've ever been in the Southern Ocean and your ship is joined by one of these amazing things with the body as big as a child and wings 12 feet long, you'll never forget it. But in the North Pacific, they have a slightly smaller thing called the northern short-tailed albatross, Phoebastria albatrus, which is stunningly beautiful to look at. It's almost pure white with a golden crown with a bubblegum pink beak and a little blue tip on the end. I mean, you just want to love this bird to death. And it lives mainly on a little volcanic island called Torishima, about 100 miles south of Tokyo, except because the Japanese hunted it nearly to extinction. And mainly for either making quills for writing or for stuffing mattresses with. Apparently albatross feathers are very good for mattresses. Who knew? But apparently they are. And there were only 5 breeding pairs left in the early 1970s when a young researcher called Hiroshi Hasegawa decided that he would devote the rest of his life to saving these albatrosses. And through a heroic and very intelligent program involving decoys and artificial nests and so on and so forth, he was able to go to the International Albatross Conference in Tasmania, who knew there was such a thing, but there is, and announced that the northern short-tailed albatross was now out of danger, that there were 5,000 breeding pairs left, and that that was something that you could see now regularly from the Aleutian Islands to Japan as part of the newly revivified Pacific bird life. So there are some good stories. And the American government is doing some good work. I mean, George W. Bush made an enormous marine sanctuary, and President Obama has made an even bigger one with a terribly unpronounceable Polynesian name. So there are gigantic areas which are protected, but there are these things called the ABNJs, the Areas Beyond National Jurisdiction, which used to be called the High Seas, which are under nobody's jurisdiction. And in those, ships turn their exhausts on full, they dump their rubbish overboard and overfish and despoil the ocean. And that's going on apace, and it's going to be some long while, I think, before the Pacific, big as it is able to withstand the burden of what happens out in the deep, deep waters far away from any supervision.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program features author and journalist Simon Winchester, whose latest book is Pacific, Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.